Hello, thank you for tuning in to X-Ray FM. My name is Katrina Nguyen, and I join you from the Oregon coast. My expert guest today will help educate us on a thought-provoking solution to a modern changing economy, wealth inequality, and more. Over the next couple of months, I will be covering the topic, so I encourage you to listen closely and contact the station with your questions and interests to be addressed on a future segment. My guest is Scott Santens. Scott Santens is a writer, public speaker, and advocate for universal basic income, frequently referred to as UBI. He's the founder and president of the Income to Support All Foundation, a nonprofit that supports projects that help achieve UBI. He's also a senior advisor for Humanity Forward, which educates lawmakers on policy solutions. Scott is a founding member of the Economic Security Project, an advisor to the Universal Income Project, a founding committee member of Basic Income Action, a committee member of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network. He has written articles for the Boston Globe, the Huffington Post, and Vox. Thank you for joining us today, Scott. So after years of being a supporter of universal basic income, it still surprises me how many people still don't know what it is. How do you go about educating newcomers to universal basic income?
First of all, thank you for the invite today. And I would just start off with the kind of the dictionary definition of basic income as defined by the Basic Income Earth Network, which was the international organization founded decades ago around this concept, that I'm considered the keepers of the definition. And that definition is a periodic cash payment unconditionally delivered to all on an individual basis without means test or work requirement. So to simplify that even a bit further, this is it's a floor of income. So it's cash, and there's no means testing or work requirement, meaning it's universal and unconditional. And this is regularly provided. So say monthly, weekly, quarterly, annually. And it's provided for everyone in a household instead of just like the household.
So there are varied reasons why people support UBI, and those unaware might be surprised at the diversity and range of people who do endorse it. But in your own words, what about UBI has inspired you to dedicate your career to pushing it forward?
I first came into the concept back in 2013, and it was through the technology angle even back then. And it's interesting too to think that there are even, the technology angle existed even back, decades ago. Even Martin Luther King was talking about the need for basic income from like an automation perspective. But I got into this through thinking about when automation impacts the labor market, which I would also argue it's been impacting us for decades. What is the best way to respond to that? And so I started looking into basic income as this concept that was proposed along these lines. And it was actually just looking at the evidence from the various pilots that happened even back in the 70s and more recently, earlier this century, really convinced me that, okay, well, this is like an evidence-based idea that, but then beyond that, looking into the philosophical arguments for this, the many different arguments for this from all different kinds of angles, and even learning more about just the way the existing safety net works, like the realities on the ground of the existing safety net, really convinced me that UBI is a very important kind of fundamental foundational idea.
So for people who are listening and they heard your technical definition of what UBI is, let's put it into kind of terms that they can understand. So for example, it would be like 500 a month or 1,000 a month to every single person in a, in a country that's supporting it. Is that a fair, like a basic understanding that everyone could understand?
Yeah. It's basically cash for everyone. Whereas, everyone can be defined in various ways. So, one example is Alaska has had what could be considered to be a universal basic income since 1982, because everyone there receives a payment every year without means tests or work requirement. And it goes to everyone in a household and actually goes to both children and adults alike. Whereas you could also argue that a universal basic income could exclude kids, even though I would suggest that kids should be included. Also, it's in Alaska, that payment is per resident. So where the resident is, residency is defined as like the full, an amount of time the previous year is being there. So this can be for citizens or it can be for all legal residents. So there's some, you can find universal in various ways, but the point of this is yes, like pretty much everybody.
So in my years of supporting UBI, I've come across some interesting concerns from others. I thought it would be great to get your response to some of them. Some are pretty common. I'm sure you've heard of them. A few maybe not so common, but bear with me. I've talked to a wide range of people within the political spectrum. And they all have their varying concerns. So the first one is universal basic income communism or socialism, and can it be used to control populations?
Yeah, it's interesting to come across these. This idea is very much cross-partisan. There's support from all across the spectrum, throughout history. It's hard to call something either socialism or communism that was actually supported by Milton Friedman himself. This is supported by Friedrich Hayek. These are free market, kind of libertarian lovers of capitalism, So it to call it communism would be like calling a Milton Friedman communist, which is pretty silly. It would be like saying that Alaska is a communist state in the US. That's silly. Instead, it's cash. So this is cash. It's money to spend in markets. It's a way of I would argue better calculating or efficiently calculating, the price mechanism to achieve supply and demand. What is it that consumers are demanding, and it's hard to signal demand if you lack any means of signaling that demand via cash. So it actually, I would argue, makes markets function better. And when it comes to questions of power, again, this is unconditional in its cash. So in order to be considered UBI, it has to be cash and it has to be unconditional. So if something somehow has strings attached, then it's conditional and therefore not basic income. And if something is not cash, like some kind of voucher that limits you to certain things, that's not basic income. So being cash and being unconditional means that, there is no one who can tell you what to do with it. They can't take it away with you for behaving in ways that they don't approve of. Whereas those concerns actually like fit quite well with existing conditional safety nets. Like we see arguments over SNAP, and SNAP is a voucher. You can't use it on all food, specifically not prepared foods. And you see arguments over whether it should be allowed to buy like seafood and stuff. And there are all these requirements, all these work requirements and conditions attached to it. So, you have to jump all these hoops to get it. And there's arguably ways to control people, using this because there are those behavioral requirements attached to do this. But basic income lacks all those things. So really, basic income is freedom. It's the power to say no and the freedom to say yes. And I would argue that's why we don't see it yet, is because that's what people fear. Like they fear what would happen if people have that level of freedom.
So, wouldn't a UBI cause the cost of living to increase?
A lot of people misunderstand this specific one. This is, yeah, the fear of higher prices, fear of inflation. This has been around a long time. It's definitely a top three fear in the US. And I'd say it probably grew a little bit in fear after COVID. People blamed stimulus as like somehow causing inflation that happened after that. But it's a good example to even look at, what did actually happen during COVID. So yes, we got that money out there, and the stimulus payments were actually a small percentage of the overall stimulus that was injected into the economy. And this was deficit spent stimulus too. So there was no attempt to match what we spent in stimulus with taxes, because of course we were looking to push up spending and fight against the potential deflationary spiral caused by, COVID. So a basic income would very most likely be matched with taxation, in which case you're not expanding the money supply you are just shifting who is has the ability to purchase from like the top 10% down below, more to the bottom 90%. And so, yes, people could spend more money, but you're not necessarily just inflating the entire supply of money. And that's what I think one thing that people really misunderstand. And also that, let's say you're someone who receives $15,000 a year in basic income. Your taxes go up, let's say $8,000 per year. So you're netting $7,000 per year. That's like your increase in consumption power is 7,000, not 15,000. So people just in general think that there's a lot more money being spent when actually by not looking at the net receipt. And that also helps them misunderstand too, like the cost of basic income as being a lot more expensive than it actually is, because you are matching this with taxes. And what matters is that net difference between what people get in basic income and what people pay in additional taxes.
Well, yeah, and I've heard a concern that, well, if everyone has money to spend, then property owners and people who sell items, they're going to hike up their prices. But I've heard the argument that, well, if everyone has expendable income, these sellers and these, property owners, whatever, they're going to have to compete with each other because people have more choice, So it's like if you hike up the prices, they're going to go to the people who aren't hiking up the prices. So it's kind of like an equalizer in my mind because it gives people more choice to pick what they want or, what works best for them.
Yeah, supply is not static. And I think a lot of people kind of assume that or don't consider that supply can adjust to demand. So, we actually have witnessed lower prices as a result of basic income in UBI pilots, especially when these are saturation pilots where like entire villages, entire towns, get this basic income. Because people are able to purchase this stuff, then you can actually create more of it. There's more competition, and that can push down on prices. When it comes to like rent, that's a really good one just to cover really quickly too. Because, yeah, like, first of all, a lot of people are in leases. So it's not like you can just immediately raise the rent, anyways. Like, you have to wait to the end of the lease term. So then, let's say your landlord raises your rent, but consider like what they would raise that to. Again, people, if it's the basic income is $1,000 a month, that doesn't mean that you have $1,000 per month more to spend, because maybe your taxes went up $900 per month, netting you $100 per month. So the landlord can't know exactly what your income is, and it would make no sense to raise it just by the amount of that. And then the other side of this is when it comes to rent and housing, basic income means more people able to buy their homes, which means fewer renters, which means a lower supply of renters, which means landlords have less people to rent to, which pushes down on prices. And then also, you've got right now, people are kind of stuck in cities, like these expensive, high cost of living areas, because that's where the jobs are. But if you disconnect survival from employment, then people are more free to move to more rural areas, exurban areas, these kinds of places. In which case, yes, you're introducing more competition between landlords across like the entire country, which again makes it harder to raise rent. So these kinds of things just people tend to not consider.
So, how can we afford or fund a universal basic income, let's say here in the States?
I like to get people to think about, what is the cost of not having a basic income? And I think it's easier to see how affordable it is. Because right now, we're spending a lot of money. Now, a lot of resources go into fighting the downstream impacts of poverty, chronic insecurity, and extreme inequality, mostly in the form of increased healthcare costs. It leads to a lot of sickness. And it leads to a lot more crime that would otherwise exist. It contributes to high recidivism rates. So people leave prison and a large percentage of them just go right back in because they just can't find any means to legally survive on their own. And it also leads to a lot of reduced productivity. There's a lot of people out there who, let's say they can't afford a car to get a job, or they can't afford schooling or training or whatever to find like better job. And also the fact that these things interact. So maybe if you're sick, then you're less able to work. Or, crime, if you're in prison, then you're less able to work. So these costs are expensive. A good way to look at this is we're spending over $1 trillion per year on the downstream costs of child poverty. Just child poverty alone leads to, these massive costs. And study was done that if we, if we spent $100 billion more per year on, say, like a universal child allowance kind of thing, then we would save potentially $1.5 trillion a year on these reduced loss of health and crime and these things. So we should see this as an investment. We would have a lot of savings via reduced crime, improved health by doing basic income. So that's like a key thing to consider. But then when it comes to like tax reforms and these kinds of things people traditionally think of when it comes to funding basic income, there's a lot of ways to go about it. And like we could just do even just replacing the standard deduction with a fully refundable standard credit that looked like the Enhanced Child Tax Credit in 2021. And that in itself would greatly reduce poverty and, have lead to a lot of these better outcomes. And sure, we can increase taxes in other ways. We can introduce some kind of consumption tax, like a value-added tax, like Andrew Yang proposed. He proposed a 10% value-added tax. We do some kind of land value tax. We could tax increasingly various forms of automation, be it like AI, robots, in various kinds of ways. Tax capital more instead of labor. But there's just a lot of options. And in general, I think we should consider the fact that we're just spending basically all this money anyways on not having basic income.
Yeah, I spoke to Carl Weiderquist last year, and he had an interesting one, taxing personal use of helicopters, even. I mean, he was talking about, like the ultra wealthy who take a helicopter to one state to the next for their like tennis lesson or something, just adding a little bit extra tax to that, to know those costs. And I was like, that's a pretty interesting idea. But
One new thing I really like that I proposed recently is just like the idea of a stock dilution tax. So this would be like an unavoidable wealth tax. You'd have basically all the big corporations that issue stock every year into a fund, and then that fund would be slowly liquidated each year. And that would result in over $1 trillion per year, around $1.5 trillion per year. It could be distributed to everybody, in the form of a dividend. And I like that idea because, especially when it comes to AI, we all trained the AI. Like we are public dollars went into the research and development behind the AI. So why don't we see ourselves as stockholders in this since we put up our capital?
So you mentioned crime rate in this last couple of minutes you were talking, and one of the concerns that someone I had spoken to, he was a crime victim. I think one of his family members was murdered or something, and he didn't like the idea of UBI because money would be going to criminals. And I know this is, I don't know your background. It sounds like you know a little bit about, the effects of like poverty and whatnot on crime. But, there are criminals who have plenty of money too. So, I know that this is not going to be a clear-cut answer, and, this is probably not your area of expertise, but what would you say to people who are concerned about money going to people who commit crime, like serious crimes, like sexual predators, violent offenders, drug and human traffickers? Again, I know this is not easy, but I'm just curious what your response is.
Yeah, I first of all, I think that basic income is just so key to act as a kind of social vaccine to immunize, like society against crime. That's entirely unnecessary. Like not to say that it would eliminate all crime, but there is a lot of crime that is survival crime. There is a lot of crime that is downstream of chronic stress. Like if you're just maybe you have enough money to not be in poverty, but you're constantly worrying about paying the bills. And that can lead to high stress, and then that leads to crime. I'm just fascinated when I first learned about basic income, looking into the pilots. As I said, I was convinced by the evidence, and part of that was the impacts on crime. Like there was the full universal experiment in Namibia around 2008, 2009. And, you know, everyone in the village of around 1,000 people got this basic income. And it reduced overall crime rates by 43%. And it reduced a specific crime, illegal hunting of like endangered animals, poaching, reduced that by 95%. So I look at that and I think, wow, like there's clearly like kinds of crime that people really don't want to do, but they engage in it because they feel they have no other choice. And whereas there's lots of other crimes where, sure, it's not because you lack the money or something. There's other reasons why you would do that. But then, you know, basic income, because it reduces stress, it just impacts so much of these things, especially like on a generation by generation level. This is, you know, you're looking at like epigenetics when you're looking at this kind of thing. Whereas, you know, we know that the environment of the womb that a child is in can impact the way that genes are expressed throughout that child's life as an adult. So, you know, these impacts happen too as a result of, again, you know, poverty and chronic insecurity. So I think that that basic income is key to reducing a bunch of crime. And I certainly don't want to prohibit people who exit the prison system from getting this either. Because, I mean, if you exit the system, then you supposedly served your time. And if you've served your time, then why would we want to create a situation where they're actually very likely to go back in prison? Like, our recidivism rates are crazy. Like, over half of people who exit prison end up going back within just like the next few years. And we've also seen for basic income pilots that we can actually significantly reduce this through basic income. So, you know, I'm really just about the outcomes. And if the outcomes show reduced crime, then I say that's the way to go. And it matters not to me about like insisting on some kind of permanent punishment of people for what they did, especially if what they did is a result of the lack of basic income.
Yeah, and I've spoken to people who were incarcerated, and once they left, they considered doing crime again because they could not find housing, they could not find a job. So I completely agree with you. It's just a really sad situation. But I want to talk about the emergence of artificial intelligence and its current and eventual effect on the economy. So several months ago, you created a pledge called the AI Pledge for Humanity. Can you explain what this is and what you aim to achieve with the pledge?
Yeah, in short, I would say the pledge is really about trying to convince people within the AI space to say put their money where their mouth is when it comes to talking about basic income. Like, you know, we've heard people like Elon Musk talk about UBI, and he even goes so far as to say that, you know, oh, we'll have universal high income, not universal basic income, kind of pointing to like, oh, we're going to have like a really, really high income. And at the same time, he's out there, you know, saying that, oh, well, you know, I don't support UBI now. I mean, I support it like at some point in the future when, you know, 50% of people or something are unable to find work. And, you know, find it very curious when people will kind of speak outside of both sides of their mouth when it comes to this issue. Like, if they believe that basic income was important, then we could actually be pushing for that right now as soon as possible, because we also are arguably already seeing the first impacts from that on the labor market. So why would we wait till things get even worse to actually make sure that we have a stronger safety net in the form of a floor? And if we're going to do that, then we need to put resources into that, like, immediately. Like, we actually need to be, you know, these people in this AI space who are, you know, billionaires or soon to be billionaires or at least millionaires, like, they've got a lot of resources they can use to start, you know, not only, you know, trying to convince government and trying to do things at the more local level, like even at the state level, just whatever they can to try to get basic income going. And that's what the AI pledge is this pledge to actually resources towards UBI, and also an acknowledgement of the fact that, again, all of us trained the AI, like all of our work was fed into these machines to, you know, better emulate us. And, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to me that all of us shouldn't see some benefit from this essentially large increases in productivity And also, no one should suffer to the point of falling to zero as a result of, a machine that made their work less necessary as a result of their own training input into the machine.
Okay, well, I'm really interested. I have a lot more questions about this pledge and artificial intelligence in general. So next month I'll have Scott back and we'll talk more about that. But as we start to wrap up in these last couple of minutes, what would you suggest to people wanting to see a, wanting to see a UBI enacted? It's going to take all of us kind of doing what we can. What can you suggest to people who say they want to get started today or tomorrow to, do their part to push it forward? What can they do?
Good question. And I don't know if I have the best answer to that question. I have multiple answers. But really, just what can you do to get involved? Everybody should ask themselves that question, and everyone kind of can have their own best answer. When I asked myself that question back in 2013, I thought, well, I love to write, and I feel that there's a whole lot of academic papers out there and not a whole lot of blog posts, social media, like speaking to people in layman's terms, simplifying things. And so that's what I started to do. And that's what, we need people asking themselves what they can do, whatever your skill set is, how can you apply it? Having conversations with other people is great. Sharing content about this is great. Diving in, learning more about it is great. My foundation has been in the process of supporting two major projects that we're excited about coming out later this year. One's a docuseries. And one is like a mass mutual aid platform that makes it possible for people to start doing basic income like right now in the here and now by essentially opting into what could be considered to be like a self-taxation of 7%, and then using that to create a floor for every member of the community. So I thought that was a potentially very impactful, immediate way of going about this. State by state, there's local politics options, there's ways of kind of copying what Alaska did and creating dividends at the state level in state by state. There's just so many different ways to get involved just based on whatever people feel is something that they could actually do and get involved with in a way that they would like to continue doing.
So, where can people go to learn more about your work and your foundation?
My website is scottsantons.com. We've got a pretty thorough FAQ there that goes into really these most frequently asked questions with answers in article form. And you can go to itsafoundation.org to support our projects. Really just go out there and seek out that information. There's tons of videos, there's tons of reading to do. You can even ask AI, and since it's trained on my work, you'll probably get a lot of questions influenced by my own writing.
Well, thanks so much for joining, and thanks to everyone listening. Like I said, next month I'll have Scott back for a closer look at an artificial intelligence, its effect on the economy, and his pledge. We may also have a special guest with us. Visit xray.fm to sign up for X-Ray FM's email newsletter to be notified of this discussion and other X-Ray FM highlights. Thank you.